south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. Before we get to the juice, the dirt, and the details of Expat Eddie's love life, continued from the last Expat Files show, that was show number 740, by the way, this being show 741, that is for anyone who's actually counting. Anyway, I have to admit, I get a lot of emails about Puerto Rico. You know, it is a Latin country. However, don't recommend that place at all. You know, it was pretty much completely destroyed by that gigantic hurricane, and still half the island does not have power. Not to mention, even before the hurricane, the government was completely bankrupt. And the hurricane dug them an even bigger hole, multiplied the bankruptcy problem by three, if that's even possible. I mean, bankrupt is bankrupt, right? Yes, I know. You've heard Doug Casey and the guys with Sovereign Man and many other of the newsletters, the good ones, the alternative newsletters, saying if you've got any kind of business at all, if you incorporate it in Puerto Rico, you pay no federal tax, which is true. And for the longest time, it sounded like a great deal. And it was. Except, like I said, the country's bankrupt. The whole place is a bloody, flooded-out mess. And half the island doesn't have electricity. So what's the point of incorporating your business and moving down to Puerto Rico under those conditions? Where every Puerto Rican and his brother is trying to leave. And you know, they can go to the States legally. Since they're a U.S. protectorate, why do you think in big cities like Miami and Nueva York, there's such huge populations and barrios of people with Puerto Rican ancestry? Because they have U.S. passports and can get in completely legally. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, every U.S. protectorate has that privilege. But what I'm saying is, everyone who lives on that island's trying to get the hell out. All right, so you know my opinion on that. If you think I'm wrong, isn't it funny how those alternative newspapers and blogs that were so high on Puerto Rico not so long ago, have you noticed they've completely clammed up about it? And the silence is deafening. Reminds me of big bloated rags like International Living who were touting Panama, Mexico, and Costa Rica. Oh, they had real estate to sell, all right. And they did it for years, but now the silence is deafening. And now International Living's out to destroy Ecuador and Nicaragua and Colombia for expat gringos too. Because you see, with their help and promotion, the gringos file in and soon enough destroy the gringo advantage I'm always talking about, as well as greatly escalate the cost of living too. And you know, I used to live in Costa Rica. That was one of my first stops many years ago when I first took off from your Uncle Sam's Big Brother land. So I do have a lot of gringo friends still living there because, well, they bought and invested a long time ago and they aren't free to just pick up and leave. Point here is every last one of them regrets moving to Costa Rica. In fact, as soon as they open their mouths, I know I'm going to get a barrage of complaints. But at least, as a couple of them has mentioned, they'll be out of harm's way when the dominoes fall and the reset button gets pushed up in the States. So they've got that going for them anyway. And you know, one day I was sitting around with a bunch of those guys and gals, and I said, man, with more than half the gringos and expats living in Costa Rica, and that's a huge number, retired, receiving pensions, Social Security, disability payments, in some ways it's kind of like a high-functioning geriatric holding pen. What are they going to do when the feces hits the ventilator up in the States and those payments just don't come steadily like they once did? And every last one of them looked at each other, then looked at me and said, why, we'll just move to Nicaragua. In fact, practically everyone who's been in Costa Rica a long, long time will tell you that Nicaragua is like Costa Rica was 25 years ago. And believe me, for the last couple of years, there's been a steady flow of disgruntled gringos who can make the break flowing into Nicaragua because it's cheaper and it's a lot less regulated. That's reason number 426 why I'm not hot on Nicaragua either. First of all, they've got a socialist pedophile dictator running the place, but you knew that already, right? Secondly, the place is a furnace. It's dead hot. They've got no comfortable high-elevation altiplanos to speak of. Thirdly, they've got mainstream rags like International Living pushing the place as the next latest greatest retirement haven. And that'll affect the cost of living and kill your gringo advantage in a hurry. And finally, you've got tens of thousands of disgruntled gringos living in Costa Rica that say their plan B, actually it would be their plan C, would be to move there. And you know, a couple of years ago, that would have been a good idea, but things do change. Unfortunately, in Nicaragua's case, for the worse. Okay, well, that's just my opinion, and I've only been down here 28 years now. Speak the language, built 13 houses, lived on the beach and in the Altiplano. Been to every Latin country, I think, except Guyana. Lived on the Gringo Tourist Trail, had a couple businesses there too for 3 solid years, and for the next 25 years, I've been by choice well off the Gringo Tourist Trail. However, I'm not disconnected from the modern world. Where I live and hang out is first world all the way. Anyway, sometimes an entire week or two will go by and I won't run into a single gringo. Now, for the average new arrival, the green gringo expat, that might sound like torture, not having any gringos to shoot the breeze with face to face. Hey, I understand that. Long time ago, I was exactly in that position too. When your Spanish really sucks, just doing basic things can be awkward, which is why I always recommend when you first come down, wherever you're going to rent, and I always recommend renting at least 6 months before you buy anything, make sure you're close enough to a tourist area or tribe of gringos that you can get there within an hour's drive. That way you can get your gringo companionship fix. Then you can do what a lot of smart gringos and expats do. Slowly but surely, as you learn Spanish, wean yourself away from all those gringos and move away from the tourist area. Problem is, a lot of people fall into the gringo dependency thing, which is why 90 to 95% of all gringos live on or near the tourist trail. And that's also why so many gringos and expats never learn their Spanish well enough to really understand what's going on in the culture. Though you'd be surprised how many gringos and expats end up jumping right back on some kind of treadmill once they get down here and find out they've got a lot of time on their hands. Though admittedly, it's a different kind of treadmill. Up in the States, you were on that treadmill because you needed to be to exist in that society. You know, to have all the toys and goodies, SUVs, paid a big rent and everything. Whereas down here, if you end up on some kind of treadmill, it's of your own making, and a lot of gringos will tell you it's an enjoyable kind of treadmill. Go figure, huh? I mean, look, as for intelligent, kind of enlightened people, they always have to have a goal. And when they reach it, you know, it's cool, but sometimes they go into a slump. They need another goal. But I'm preaching to the choir, I know. So I started the show today talking about how people send me emails regarding Puerto Rico. And I stated, it's my opinion that it's not recommended. Not even for a nice beach resort vacation, because the place is pretty much destroyed. Well, I also get lots of email inquiries asking about Cuba. And you know, it's been a long time since we've checked in on that subject. Of course, you know, Obama opened the doors a bit, then Trump came in and closed them. And you longtime listeners have probably heard me mention that I've been there a couple times. Even checked out a variety of business opportunities with a buddy of mine from Costa Rica who is a hotel developer. A half Costa Rican, half Dutch guy who decided that getting in bed with the Cuban government on a hotel project was just way too complicated. Unless you were a big, well-known hotel chain like Marriott or Hyatt. But coming in as a private hotel owner and doing a one-off for a smaller hotel wasn't worth it. Especially now, the Airbnb thing has taken off. Man, that's a development that's taken its toll on traditional hotels, that's for sure. And in a way, you know, you gotta love it. Especially in tourist areas where hotel prices are almost always much higher than they really should be. So anyway, I get a lot of emails about Cuba. And many, many of them, probably 40 or 50% of them, come from the older 50 crowd. People who are worried about healthcare and have medical issues and talk about all the great things they've heard about the Cuban medical system. And how Cuban medical schools are cranking out so many highly skilled doctors that they are now Cuba's number one export. I'm not kidding. For example, Argentina, they have lots of medical schools too. But their MD graduates want to practice in the big city where the money is so they can buy cars, houses, and such. They don't want to work out in the boonies where they just might get paid in frijoles and driveway chickens. Which is why every medium and large Latin city has plenty of doctors and specialists. Probably just as many per capita as you have up in Cleveland. But out in the boonies in Latin America, there's a huge shortage of doctors and medical professionals because no one wants to get paid in pineapples and avocados. Or marijuana and cocaine. Though I could be wrong about that. Anyway, those little towns and pueblos out in the third world boonies have become a huge market for the export of Cuban doctors. So when you graduate from medical school as a Cuban doctor, you can practice in Cuba for a salary of something like 60 to 80 bucks a month, or go to another country and make their minimum wage, which is 3 or 4 times higher. Those are deals that the Castro government has worked out with other countries. Again, like Argentina, Belize, Bolivia, whatever. And the Cuban government gets paid by the other country. And the doctor gets shipped out to the Argentine boonies, where he's told he'll be paid that country's minimum wage, which is fantastic to him. It's usually 4 times what he's getting in Cuba. And after his 2 or 4 year contract's up, he's got to go back home. which is why the Cuban government rarely lets a single Cuban doctor, man or woman, enter into one of those contracts. They want them married, preferably with kids. Because, wouldn't you know it, once they've had a taste of the outside world, they don't want to go back. So, if you're a single doc, you're generally stuck in Cuba. So, what's really the story on Cuban healthcare in the country? Well, on my last visit, I was hanging around Havana, and I stopped into the big national hospital. I should clarify that. That's all they've got in Cuba, is national hospitals and clinics. They have no private ones. Anyway, I checked this hospital out. It had everything. First world all the way. A lot of Russian equipment. Still, very impressive. Till I found out later that hospital is first rate because it's their showplace hospital. That's where the party members and ailing tourists go. It's the poster child hospital for their so-called superior medical system. However, I found out later the hospitals in the medium and smaller sized towns were just like third world government hospitals everywhere. Shortages of practically everything. Paper products, medicines, disposables, as well as scratched and dented machines and diagnostic equipment decades older than the stuff I saw in the big Havana hospital. And as usual, most of the stuff was poorly maintained or they didn't have replacement parts, so a lot of the stuff just sat there rotting away. So bottom line, as long as you're a tourist or party member, you get sick around Havana, you'll get really top-notch, first-rate medical care. But as for the other 400 or so hospitals in Cuba, well, let's just say if you're going to get sick, you better get sick in Havana. So just to dispel any popular myths you might have about this great healthcare system in Cuba, I want to read you this little op-ed piece from a guy named Nelson Rodriguez Chartrand. He graduated from a Cuban law school, but was not allowed to practice there because the Cuban government regime decides what your job's going to be, not you. All right, this is translated, and I'll paraphrase a bit. The title is The Wonders of Cuba's One-Horsepower Ambulances. Then they show a picture of a Cuban ambulance being pulled around, you guessed it, by a horse, and that's not unusual. There's a whole fleet of them. Now later, when we get around to posting this show on YouTube, you'll see these one-horsepower ambulances. All right, it says, it's an insult to human dignity and intelligence to listen to Cuban dictators preach loudly and without hesitation that Cuba is a healthcare powerhouse, when if you've ever lived or been in Cuba, you'd see that anyone with a single shred of dignity would find it very difficult to live with Cuba's healthcare hypocrisy. If you live there, it's certainly revolting to hear Cuban leaders speak of the virtues of their healthcare system, knowing that they sell this idea worldwide with great success. How they're able to whitewash a really disgusting image and sell it and export it so successfully is a mystery. In fact, I've been told and read over and over again that other countries would love to emulate the Cuban example. Wow, if they only knew the truth. Obviously, they've never been to Cuba, and if they have, they've only been in the tourist areas. So I won't talk about poor hygiene and the lack of even food in the local hospitals, nor will I discuss the severe shortage of medicines, the unreliability of all the medical equipment, or the discontent of the professionals and workers in the healthcare business due to low wages and terrible working conditions. In Cuba, it's never healthy to show your discontent. You have to put on a happy face. You learn that quickly. Then he says, I won't talk here about the deficit of doctors due to excessive exports of all of our healthcare professionals to other countries, whose true purpose is to paint the dictators in Cuba in a false image of philanthropy and goodwill. Not to mention it's a great source of desperately needed foreign income. It's not hard to see that their major export is socialism, and up to now, its biggest buyer has been, can you believe it? Venezuela. Though in an odd sense, it's really capitalism. Oil for doctors. In fact, he says, Venezuela has spent more money on Cuba than the entire Soviet Union did before the collapse. For decades, cheap Cuban doctors for cheap Venezuelan oil made good business sense. All the while, the rest of the world was thinking, what a wondrous thing, the Cuban healthcare system. They overflow with so many great doctors, they have to export them, spreading their so-called healthcare wealth to the rest of Latin America and the world. However, there are so many factors at play in a healthcare system, I'd just like to focus on one right now. The Cuban Ambulance Service, known as the Integrated System of Medical Emergencies of Cuba, or SIUM, SIUM. What the rest of the world will never know unless they live in the outskirts of the tourist areas is that In the great healthcare powerhouse of Cuba, the inhabitants of hundreds of little pueblos, for example, one called Natrógino, a rural community located in the Camagüey province, do not have any access at all to ambulances, or in fact, basic emergency services. Recently, a 90-year-old man in terrible health had to be transferred to a hospital in a neighbor's horse-drawn cart because they were unsuccessful in summoning the SIUM services. They just were unavailable. So this 90-year-old guy suffered a two-mile journey over impassable roads in a horse-drawn cart, finally arriving at the hospital. And then, when the well-intentioned neighbor, the owner of the horse cart, complained about the lack of hospital transportation services, he was fined. And his summons said he'd use an unauthorized, precarious means of transporting a medically compromised person. So that's the way it is in socialist Cuba. Even good Samaritans get fined. So if you dare to want to help another when the state fails, and it almost always fails, don't think it's better to give than receive. Instead, you must think of the consequences. Or as they say up in the first world, no good deed goes unpunished. So next time you're in a discussion and you hear someone going on and on about the wonders of the Cuban healthcare system, if you really want to know the truth from the horse's mouth, you need to talk to a Cuban doctor. But don't talk to a doctor in Cuba. You must talk to one of the Cuban doctors who's been farmed out on contract to another Latin country, because only then they'll feel confident enough to speak freely. Even so, before they answer frankly, they'll look around and tell you, no photos, no recordings, no names, please. I'll speak, but off the record. All right, me, Johnny, here again. You know, I pay close attention when people speak off the record. That's how you get down to the nitty-gritty and the dirt. Speaking of real and very good information, my next Expat Insider Seminar will take place in Central America, in and around Guatemala again. Why? Because I've really got some fantastic connections down here. And secondly, it's only one of the 2% of the physical locations in Latin America that's in the Altiplano, meaning you really have spring-like weather all year round. So if you plan things right, whether you're building, renting, or buying, you won't have an air conditioning or a heating bill. Now, I know some gringos come down and say, man, Johnny, you know, it can get down to 50 degrees at night sometimes. And it's true, every once in a while a cold front comes through and you get some pretty cool temperatures. Though never freezing, you still should pay attention to the orientation of your house or rental. If it's out in direct sunlight all day, well, you'll probably have the windows open to get some breezes so the place doesn't overheat. And it'll be somewhat the reverse if you're in the shade all day. That means your house or rental, whatever, will always be a little cooler. But I can tell you for a fact that, for example, the house that I'm in right now in the middle of the coffee fields is always at a very comfortable temperature. That's one of the good things about cement block construction, the only way to go. The sheer mass of it really helps to stabilize the temperature. I have a good thermometer mounted on an inside wall in the house, and I can tell you for a fact over an entire year, and this place is right smack dab in the Altiplano around 5,500 feet above sea level, yet the temperature all year round only swings between around 62 and 74 degrees, mostly hovering right around 70 degrees. But it's true for the 2 or 3 months it's in the 60s, you do occasionally have to wear a sweatshirt or a sweater. Unless you're a Canadian, then you drag out the Speedo and the string bikini. So I admit, for a month or two out of the year, I wear a sweater or a sweatshirt around the house. But never ever have I had an air conditioning or heating bill. Now, of course, I run into fresh green gringos, rather delicate fresh green gringos, who come down and say, Johnny, at night it gets so cold. Where can I buy a space heater? And some of them have told me they search high and low and just can't find one, and they end up ordering one on Amazon. And I say, well, you just haven't been to the right places, because they've got Ace Hardwares all over the place here in Latin America. They're called Samacos. They've got those EPA hardware stores, too. They're gigantic Latin versions of Home Depot, so you can't find them. You just have to be on the lookout. I've even seen the oil-filled ones that look like miniature radiators. Though, oddly enough, I've never seen an electric space heater in a Latin person's house. Not even in the house of a very wealthy Latin person. Which is why, I guess, only a few hardware stores carry those things. Of course, quite a few gringos in the Altiplano have one or two of those space heaters. And you know, I'll bet a Litecoin that the closer you get to the gringo tourist trail, the more hardware stores are carrying those things. Of course, everywhere else in Latin America, the 98% of the geographic terrain that's not in the Altiplano, well, there'd really be no use at all for a space heater of any kind, because those places are the definition of tropical heat. Even at night, sometimes you'll sweat your butt off. So that info about space heaters is specifically directed at people living in the Altiplano. Far as I'm concerned, the only place to live. Unless, of course, you truly plan on spending the rest of your life next to your pool with a Mai Tai in each hand. Hey, you know, that is the American fantasy. When I was back up in the States many years ago, I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, especially teachers and government workers, man, my idea of retirement is getting a little place by the beach, laying in a hammock by the pool, looking at the ocean, and sucking down umbrella drinks. Well, you know, that gets old pretty fast. For me, it took about 2 weeks. But I'm a type A personality guy. If you're a type B or C, probably take you a couple of months to get sick and tired of that kind of living. I personally don't like the idea that if you live in the low altitudes or on or near the beach in Latin America, you have to live with a continuous fine coat of sweat on you, 24/7. And if you do any kind of halfway physical activity at all, man, you spend half the day looking for shade. In fact, a gringo friend of mine, a former building contractor now living in La Ceiba, Honduras, tells me he likes to tinker. He builds furniture and stuff. Now, La Ceiba's right on the Caribbean, so it's in the lowlands and dead hot. And he tells me the only time he can work on his hobby is between around sunup and 10 in the morning. After that, it's just way too hot. By 10, he tells me he's not only got ring around the pits in the collar, unless he's sitting down and immobile, he's thoroughly drenched in sweat. And by noon, sometimes he's already down to 6-pack of beer. I've heard his wife complain about that too. She said, why don't you build your furniture and stuff at night? He says, at night, I like to work in the daytime, out in the sun or in the shade. At night, the bugs would eat me alive. And you know, if you douse yourself in off or raid, it's not good for you and you can't get the stink off and it lingers in your bedroom too. Another good reason to live in the Altiplano, huh? There's almost no bugs. Unless you live right by a lake or a river or body of water. I can't tell you how many gringos and expats have said, Johnny, I can't believe it. There's almost no insects here. Yet the media in the States is always talking about dengue, typhoid, and Zika virus. Well, here in Latin America, those problems exist, all right. But mostly they affect poor populations who live around rivers and lakes and in the lowlands. Though occasionally you do hear about gringo backpackers and hikers picking up an illness from an insect vector. By the way, almost all the people infected don't have screens on their windows. And most people, especially the poor, leave their windows open all day, you know, because they've got metal roofs. If they don't keep the air flowing through all day, the sun will just bake the hell out of them. Which is why all middle and upper middle class housing, the kind you'll be in, has either a concrete roof painted white or Spanish tile, which has a natural cooling effect. That, by the way, is how you spot a crappy neighborhood from a distance. Metal roofs, crappy neighborhood, Spanish tile, upscale neighborhood. And when you spot a lot of concrete roofs from a distance, well, it's a bit harder to tell just what kind of neighborhood you're in. You have to get a little closer. All right, so I got off track again. I was talking about my expat insider seminar and why I usually have it in and around Guatemala. One of the reasons, of course, is smack dab in the Altiplano. Though there are other Latin countries with Altiplano regions, Guatemala has the largest continuous stretch of Altiplano compared to its total landmass. So anyway, my July 2018 expat insider seminar starts on Saturday, July 7th, and goes through Thursday, July 12th. So if you want to get in on the early bird discounts and on the early bird mailing list, send me an email at theexpatfiles@gmail.com and put the word seminar in the subject box, and you'll be getting all the details and info shortly. All right, I promised in the last show that I'd finish off that story on how expat Eddie met Claudia, his Salvadorian fiancé. Well, to refresh your memory a little bit, if you recall, we were at La Libertad Beach in El Salvador, popular little beach town, especially during the holidays when people have time off and there are lots of events organized. And the big beer and soda companies hire beautiful young models and local two-bit celebrities to hand out free product samples on the beach. Then they'll have this event called a Bikini Open, the highlight of the afternoon. Now, one thing I might have failed to mention is that El Salvador has almost no gringos. And even though there are some rather nice places there, including La Libertad Beach, there must have been 1,000 people there, and expat Eddie and I, I'm sure, were the only two gringos. So anyway, if you remember the story from last time, it was getting towards the end of the night. We were sitting around the beach bar, and Claudia, the winner of the swimsuit contest, one of the local celebrities, in fact, the poster girl for Banana Boat Sunscreen. So for the Latin crowd, she was recognizable all over El Salvador. So anyway, as the story goes, some muscle-bound guy was drunk and hassling her a bit. She got jostled and spilled a drink on herself and Eddie. By the way, she didn't know us from Adam, and we didn't know her except from the Banana Boat posters. But at the moment, in a huff, she commanded Eddie to buy her a drink. wrong thing to say to Eddie. And he said, I'm not going to buy you a drink. She went off in a huff. And we figured she was just one of those stuck-up, high-maintenance girls who'd been catered to all their life because of her beauty. Then, suddenly, as the bar was closing, she appeared in front of Eddie and apologized. We figured no guy had ever talked to her like that before. It figures, since being a local celebrity, she'd always been surrounded by ass-kissers. Well, to make a long story short, she'd never gone out with a gringo before. How could she? Gringos are rare in Salvador. Turns out she was certainly used to unimaginative Latin macho pickup lines. And Eddie was not a BSer and not one to lay on the syrupy stuff, which intrigued her. Now, as for Eddie, he told me on their very first date, he told her he didn't think they had much hope of making it a lasting thing. He said in a nice way he didn't want to get involved with a high-maintenance glamour girl. But as he soon found out, she chipped in her modeling job money to help out the family, her mom and two younger sisters. So although she looked and dressed and sometimes acted like she was high maintenance, she was taking money from no one. By the way, high maintenance Latina style is a lot different than high maintenance gringa style. She and her mom were holding down the fort and supporting the family, since daddy had abandoned them a long time ago. Now, if you remember, in the last show, an email got us started on the life and loves of expat Eddie. And the emailer said, rightly so, that he didn't think expat Eddie would tolerate an airheaded, Kardashian-esque bimbo who was only interested in fashion, photo shoots, and discos. Well, he got that right. Except the very first time she invited him to her house to meet the family, which was a very positive and serious sign on her part. By the way, they never met a gringo either. Anyway, when she showed him around her little middle-class house and her room, in the corner, she had a drafting table, a propane torch, a soldering iron, and a shelf full of various art supplies. And on the floor were a half a dozen or so very nice stained and leaded glass windows. Turns out she had talent and depth after all. However, like she told Eddie, she'd been in a number of little art shows and sold a few pieces, but she could never make a living at it. Her dream was to someday have an art supply shop and gallery. So she did have talent, and besides that, she'd drawn some very nice charcoal portraits of her family and the family dog. Come on, why do women always have pictures of their dogs? Needless to say, Eddie was impressed. She wasn't just an extremely pretty face. He was also quite impressed by the stack of art books she had on the shelf. Some were in English, even though she didn't speak English. All right, we're getting towards the end of the show now, but there's more to the story. The part where it gets kind of dark and tense and intense. So we'll pick up where we left off on the next show, so stay tuned. You've been listening to the Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, you can schedule a one-on-one phone call with me. But first, download my free Plan B questionnaire at www.thenewexpat.com. Better yet, if you want to get your Plan B going from right up there in the States, just sign up for my 9-hour Expat Essentials course. Get the perfect Plan B blueprint by going to theexpatfiles.com/academy. Nos vemos.